he done it for himself or for us? There was half a cup of coffee left in the jug, and I poured it into a second mug and carried it carefully through to the bedroom. Judah was lying sprawled across the mattress as if he'd fallen there. People in films always look peaceful in sleep, but Judah didn't. His battered mouth was hidden beneath his upflung arm, but with his angular nose and furrowed brow he looked like an angry hawk, shot down by a gamekeeper mid-flight and still pissed off about it. I set the coffee cup very gently on his bedside table, and putting my face down on the pillow next to him, kissed the back of his neck. It was warm and surprisingly soft. He stirred in his sleep, putting out one long tanned arm to loop over my shoulders, and his eyes opened, looking three shades darker than their usual hazel brown. "Hey," I said softly.
"Hey."
He scrunched up his face and yawned, then pulled me down beside him. For a moment I resisted, thinking of the boat and the train and the car waiting for me at Hull. Then my limbs seemed to melt like plastic, and I let myself fold down next to him, into his warmth. We lay there for a moment, staring into each other's eyes, and I reached out and tentatively touched the Steri-Strip across his lip. "Think it'll reroute?"
"I don't know," he said. "I hope so. I got to go to Moscow on Monday, and I don't want to be messing around with dentists while I'm out there."
I said nothing. He closed his eyes and stretched, and I heard his joints click. Then he rolled onto his side and put his cupped hand gently over my bare breast. "Judah," I said. I could hear the mix of exasperation and longing in my voice.
"What?"
"I can't. I've got to go."
"So go."
"Don't. Stop that."
"Don't stop? Or don't stop?"
He gave a slow, lopsided smile.
"Both.
You know which one I mean." I pulled myself upright and shook my head. It hurt, and I regretted the movement instantly.
"Your cheek okay?"
Judah asked.
"Yeah."
I put a hand up to it. It was swollen, but not as much as before. His face was troubled, and he put out a finger to stroke the bruise, but I flinched away in spite of myself.
"I should have been there," he said.
"Well, you weren't," I said, more snappishly than I'd meant. "You never are." He blinked and pulled himself up on his elbows to look at me, his face still soft with sleep, crumpled with marks from his pillow.
"What the... You heard me?"
I knew I was being unreasonable, but the words came tumbling out.
"What's the future, Jude? Even if I move in here, what's the plan? Do I sit here weaving my shroud like Penelope and keeping the home fires burning while you drink scotch in some bar in Russia with the other foreign correspondents?"
"Where'd this come from?"
I shook my head and swung my legs out of bed. I began pulling on the spare clothes I'd left on the floor after the trip to A&E.
"I'm just tired, Jude."
Tired was an understatement. I hadn't slept longer than 2 hours in the last 3 nights.
"And I can't see where this is heading. It's hard enough now when it's just the two of us. I don't want to be the wife stuck at home with a kid and a raging case of postnatal depression while you're getting shot at in every hellhole this side of the equator."
"Recent events kind of imply I'm in more danger in my own apartment," Judah said, and then winced as he saw my face. "Sorry, that was an asshole thing to say.
It was an accident, I know that."
I swung my still damp coat round my shoulders and picked up my bag. "Bye, Judah."
"Bye? What do you mean, bye?"
"Whatever you want."
"What I want is for you to stop acting like a goddamn drama queen and move into my flat. I love you, Lo."
The words hit me like a slap. I stopped in the doorway, feeling the weight of my tiredness like something physical around my neck, pulling me down. Hands in pale latex, the sound of a laugh.
"Hello?" Judah said, uncertainly.
"I can't do this," I said, my face to the hallway. I wasn't sure what I was talking about. I can't leave. I can't stay. I can't have this conversation, this life, this everything. I have to go.
"So, that job,"
he said, the beginnings of anger in his voice.
"The one I turned down? Are you saying I was wrong?"
"I never asked you to do that," I said. My voice was shaking. "I never asked you, so don't you put that on me." I hoisted my bag up onto my shoulder and turned to the door. He didn't say anything. He didn't try to stop me. I walked out of the flat reeling like I was half drunk. It was only when I got on the tube that the reality of what had just happened hit me. Chapter 5. I love ports. I love the smell of tar and sea air and the scream of the gulls. Maybe it's years of taking the ferry to France for summer holidays, but a harbour gives me a feeling of freedom in a way that an airport never does. Airports say work and security checks and delays. Ports say, I don't know, something completely different. Escape, maybe. I had spent the train journey avoiding thoughts of Judah and trying to distract myself with research on the trip ahead. Richard Bulmer was only a few years older than me, but his CV was enough to make me feel hopelessly inadequate. A list of businesses and directorships that made my eyes water, each a stepping stone to an even higher level of money and influence. When I brought up Wikipedia on my phone, it showed a bronzed, handsome man with very black hair, arm in arm with a stunningly beautiful blonde in her late 20s. Richard Bulmer with his wife, the heiress Anne Lyngstad, at their wedding in Stavanger, said the caption. Given his title, I'd assumed that his wealth had been handed to him on a plate, but it looked, from Wikipedia at least, as if I'd been unfair. The early part of the picture was cushy enough, prep school, Eton and Balliol. However, in his first year at university, his father had died. His mother seemed already to be out of the picture, it wasn't entirely clear, and the family estate had been swallowed up in death duty and debts, leaving him, at 19 years old, homeless and alone. Under those circumstances, the fact that he got through Oxford with a degree would have been achievement enough, but he had also created a dot-com startup in his third year. Its stock market flotation in 2003 was the first in his string of successes, culminating with this boutique 10-cabin cruise liner conceived as a super-luxury retreat for hopping the Scandinavian coastline. Available for the wedding of your dreams, a dazzling corporate event to woo your clients with the wow factor, or simply for an exclusive holiday you and your family will never forget. I read from the press pack as the train hurtled north, before turning to a floor plan of the cabin deck. There were four large suites in the nose of the boat, the prow, I suppose you'd call it, and a separate section with six smaller cabins arranged in a horseshoe shape at the back. Each cabin was numbered, odd and even, on either side of a central corridor, with cabin one right in the tip of the prow, and cabins 9 and 10 adjoining each other in the curved stern of the boat. I guessed I'd be in one of the smaller cabins. Presumably the suites were reserved for VIPs. There were no measurements on the floor plan, and I frowned, remembering some of the cross-channel ferries I'd been on, the claustrophobic, windowless little rooms. The thought of spending 5 days in one of those wasn't a comfortable one, but surely on a boat like this we'd be talking something considerably more spacious. I turned the page again, hoping to find a photo of one of the cabins to reassure myself, But instead, I was confronted with a shot of a dazzling array of Scandinavian delicacies spread out on a white cloth. The chef on the Aurora had trained at Noma and El Bulli, apparently. I yawned and pressed my hands into my eyes, feeling the grit of tiredness and the weight of everything from last night pressing down on me once again. Judah's face as I'd left him, stitched up with the blow from the night before, came into my head and I flinched. I wasn't even sure what had happened. Had Judah and I broken up? Had I dumped him? Every time I tried to reconstruct the conversation, my exhausted brain took over, adding in stuff I hadn't said, the responses I wished I'd made, making Judah more clueless and more insulting to justify my own position, or more unconditionally loving to try to convince myself this was all going to be okay. I hadn't asked him to turn down the job, so why was I suddenly expected to be grateful for it? I dozed off for about 30 painful minutes in the car from the station to the port, and when the driver's cheerful announcement broke into my sleep, it was like a splash of cold water to the face. I stumbled out of the car into searing sunshine and the salt sting of the breeze, feeling bleary and dazed. The driver had dropped me off almost at the end of the Aurora's gangway, but as I looked across the steel bridge to the boat, I couldn't quite believe we were in the right place. What I saw was familiar from the brochure, huge glass windows reflecting the sun without a single fingerprint or speck of salt water, and gleaming white paint so fresh that it could have been finished that morning. But what had been missing was a sense of scale. The Aurora was so small, more like a large yacht than a cruise liner. Now I saw what they meant by boutique. I'd seen bigger boats hopping around the Greek islands. It seemed impossible that everything mentioned in the brochure, library, sunroom, spa, sauna, cocktail lounge, and all the other things apparently indispensable to the Aurora's pampered passengers, could fit into this miniature vessel. Its size, along with the perfection of its paintwork, gave it a curiously toy-like quality, and as I stepped onto the narrow steel gangway, I had a sudden disorienting image of the Aurora as a ship imprisoned in a bottle. Tiny, perfect, isolated, and unreal. And of myself, shrinking down to match it with every step I took towards the boat. It was a strange feeling, as if I were looking down the wrong end of a telescope. And it gave me a dizzying sensation, almost like vertigo. The gangway shifted beneath my feet, the oily, inky waters of the harbour swirling and sucking beneath, and I had a momentary illusion that I was falling, the steel beneath my feet giving way. I shut my eyes and gripped the cold metal rail. Then I heard a woman's voice from up ahead.
"It's a wonderful smell, isn't it?"
I blinked. A stewardess was standing in the entrance to the ship. She was bright, almost white blonde, tanned walnut brown, and was beaming as if I were her rich, long-lost relative from Australia. I took a breath, trying to steady myself, and then made my way along the rest of the gangway and onto the Aurora Borealis.
"Welcome, Miss Blacklock,"
the stewardess said as I entered. Her accent was clipped in a way I couldn't place, and her words somehow managed to convey the impression that encountering me was a life experience on a par with winning the lottery.
"I am so very pleased to welcome you on board. Can one of our porters take your case?"
I looked around me, trying to work out how she knew who I was. My bag was gone before I could protest.
"Can I offer you a glass of champagne?"
I said, distinguishing myself with witty repartee. The stewardess took that for a yes, and I found myself accepting the dewy flute she put into my hand.
Thanks.
The interior of the Aurora was gobsmacking. The boat might have been small, but they had crammed in enough bling for a vessel 10 times the size. The gangway doors opened onto the landing of a long, curving staircase in which every surface that could be French polished, encased in marble, or draped with raw silk had been so. The whole flight was illuminated by an eye-watering chandelier, suffusing the place with tiny splashes of light that reminded me of nothing so much as the sun glinting off the sea on a summer's day. It was slightly nauseating, not in a social conscience sort of way, although if you thought about it too hard, that too, but more the disorientation it induced. The crystals acted like prisms on every drop of light, dazzling you, throwing you off balance with the sensation of peering into a child's kaleidoscope. The effect, combined with lack of sleep, was not completely pleasant. The stewardess must have seen me gawping because she gave a proud smile.
"The Great Stairway is really something, isn't it?" she said. "That one chandelier has over 2,000 Swarovski crystals."
"Gosh," I said faintly. My head throbbed, and I tried to remember if I'd packed the ibuprofen. It was hard not to blink.
"We are very proud of the Aurora," the stewardess continued warmly. "My name is Camilla Lidman, and I am in charge of hospitality on the vessel. My office is on the lower deck, and if there is anything I can do to make your stay with us more enjoyable, please do not hesitate to ask. My colleague Joseph," she indicated a smiling blonde man to her right, "will show you to your cabin and give you a tour of the facilities. Dinner is at 8, but we would invite you to join us at 7 p.m. in the Lindgren Lounge for a presentation on the boat's facilities and the wonders you can expect to enjoy on this cruise." "Ah, Mr. Lederer!"
A tall, dark man in his 40s was coming up the gangway behind us, followed by a porter struggling with a huge suitcase.
"Please be careful," he said, wincing visibly as the porter bumped the trolley over a joint in the gangway. "That case has some very delicate equipment in it."
"Mr. Lederer," said Camilla Lidman,
with the same near-delirious enthusiasm she had injected into her welcome to me. I had to hand it to her. I was impressed at her acting skills, though in the case of Mr. Lederer it probably took less effort, since he was kind of easy on the eye.
"Let me welcome you aboard the Aurora. Can I offer you a glass of champagne? And Mrs. Lederer?"
"Mrs. Lederer won't be coming."
Mr. Lederer ran a hand through his hair and glanced up at the Swarovski chandelier with an air of slight bemusement.
"Oh, I am so sorry."
Camilla Lidman's flawless brow puckered in a frown.
"I hope nothing is wrong."
"Well, she's in fine health," Mr. Lederer said. "In fact, she's fucking my best friend."
He smiled and took the champagne. Camilla blinked and then said smoothly,
"Josef, please do take Miss Blacklock to her cabin."
Josef gave a little half bow and extended a hand towards the downward sweep of the staircase.
"This way, please," he said.
I nodded dumbly and allowed myself to be ushered away, still clutching my glass of champagne. Over my shoulder I could hear Camilla telling Mr. Lederer about her office on the lower deck.
"You are in cabin 9, the Linnaeus suite,"
Josef told me as I followed him down into the beige dimness of a thickly carpeted windowless corridor.
"All the cabins are named after notable Scandinavian scientists."
"Who gets the Nobel?"
I cracked nervously. The corridor was giving me a strange, stifled feeling, a heavy weight of claustrophobia on the back of my neck. It wasn't just the size, but the soporifically low lamps and lack of natural light.
Josef answered seriously, "On this particular voyage, the Nobel suite will be occupied by Lord and Lady Bulmer. Lord Bulmer is a director of the Northern Lights Company, which owns the vessel. There are 10 cabins,"
he told me as we descended another set of stairs.
4 forward and 6 aft, all on the middle deck. Each cabin comprises a suite of up to 3 rooms, with its own bathroom, featuring full-sized bath and separate shower, full-sized double bed and private veranda. The Nobel suite has a private hot tub.
Veranda? Somehow the idea of having a veranda on a cruise ship seemed completely wrong. But I supposed, thinking about it, it was no weirder than having any other open deck area.
Hot tub?
Well, the least said about that, the better.
Every cabin has a named steward to assist you, day or night. Your stewards will be myself and my colleague Carla, who you will be meeting later this evening. We will be delighted to help you in any way we can during your stay on the Aurora.
So this is the middle deck, right? I asked.
Joseph nodded.
Yes, this deck is solely passenger suites. Upstairs you will find the dining room, spa, lounge, library, sun deck, and other public areas. All are named after Scandinavian writers, the Lindgren Lounge, the Janssen Dining Room, and so on.
Janssen?
Tove,
he supplied. Oh, of course. Moomins, I said stupidly. God, my head was aching. We had reached a panelled wooden door with a discreet plaque labelled 9, Linnaeus. Joseph threw open the door and stood back to allow me to step inside. The place was, by no exaggeration, about 7 or 8 times nicer than my flat at home, and not a great deal smaller either. Mirrored wardrobes stretched away to my right, and in the center, flanked by a sofa to one side and a dressing table to the other, was a huge double bed, the white linen expanse invitingly smooth and crisp. But the thing that made the biggest impression on me was not the space, which was impressive, but the light. Coming out of the narrow, artificially lit corridor, the light streaming in from the veranda doors opposite was blinding. Sheer white curtains waved in the breeze, and I saw that the sliding door was open. I felt an instant sense of relief, as if a tightness in my chest had lifted.
"The doors can be latched back,"
Joseph explained from behind me.
"But the catch will automatically disengage in the event of adverse weather conditions."
"Oh, great," I said vaguely, but all I could think of was how much I wanted Joseph to go, so I could flop down on the bed and sink into oblivion. Instead, I stood, awkwardly suppressing my yawns, while Joseph told me about the functions of the bathroom. Yes, I had used one before, thank you. The fridge and minibar, all complimentary, unfortunately for my liver, and explained that the ice would be refreshed twice a day and I could ring for him or Carla at any time. At last, my drooping yawns could no longer be ignored, and he gave another little bow and excused himself, leaving me to take in the cabin. There's no point in pretending I wasn't impressed. I was. Mainly by the bed, which was practically shrieking an invitation to throw myself down and sleep for 30 to 40 hours. I looked at the pristine white duvet and the gold and white scatter cushions, and longing washed through me like a physical substance in my veins, sending prickles from the nape of my neck to the tips of my fingers and toes. I needed sleep. I was beginning to crave it, like a drug addict, counting the hours until my next fix. The 30 uncomfortable minutes in the taxi had only made it worse. But I couldn't sleep now. If I did, I might not wake up, and I could not afford to miss the evening. I might be able to skip some of the functions later in the week, but I absolutely had to go to tonight's dinner and presentation. It was the first night on board. Everyone would be making contacts and networking furiously. If I missed that, it would be a huge black mark against me, and I would never catch up. Instead, forcing down a yawn, I went out to the balcony, hoping the fresh air would help me wake from the creeping fog of exhaustion that seemed to encroach every time I stopped moving or talking. The veranda was as delightful as one would imagine a private balcony on a luxury cruise ship to be. The barrier was made of glass, so that sitting inside the suite you could almost imagine there was nothing between you and the ocean at all. And there were two deck chairs and a tiny table, so that one could sit there of an evening and enjoy the midnight sun or northern lights, depending on which cruise one had booked. I spent a long, long time watching the little ships toiling in and out of Hull Harbour, feeling the salty wind in my hair. And then suddenly something about the feel of the ship changed. For a minute I couldn't think what it was, and then I realised. The engine, which had been purring discreetly for the last half hour or so, had gone up a notch, and something about the boat had shifted. With a grinding roar, we began to inch round, away from the quayside, to point out towards the sea. As I stood and watched, the boat edged out of the harbour between the green and red lights marking the channel. I felt the change in its movement as we left the shelter of the harbour wall and entered the North Sea, the smooth, lapping waves giving way to the great rolling swells of the deep ocean. Slowly, the shoreline slipped away, and the buildings of Hull dwindled into ridges on the horizon, and then into a dark line that could have been anywhere. As I watched it disappear, I thought of Judah and everything I'd left undone. My phone was heavy in my pocket, and I took it out, hoping for something from him before we left the range of the UK transmitters. Goodbye. Good luck. Bon voyage. But there was nothing. The signal dipped by one bar, and then another, and the phone in my hand was silent. As the coast of England disappeared from view, the only noise was the crashing of the waves. From Judah Lewis to Laura Blacklock. Sent Tuesday, 22nd of September. Subject:
Are you okay? Hey, honey. I haven't heard from you since your email on Sunday. Not sure if our messages are crossing. Did you get my reply or the text I sent you yesterday? Getting kind of worried and hoping you don't think I'm off somewhere being an asshole and nursing my wounds. I'm not. I love you, I miss you, and I'm thinking about you. Don't worry about what happened back home. And the tooth is okay. I think it'll reroot like the doc said. I'm self-medicating with vodka anyway. Let me know how the cruise is going, or if you're busy, just drop me a line to say you're okay. Love you, Jay.
From Rowan Lonsdale to Laura Blacklock, CC, Jennifer West. Sent Wednesday, 23rd of September. Subject: Update?
Hello, could you please reply to my email sent 2 days ago requesting an update on the cruise? Jen tells me you filed nothing and we were hoping for some kind of copy by tomorrow. A sidebar piece at the least. Please let Jen know ASAP where you're at with this and CC me into your reply. Rowan.
Part 2. Chapter 6. Even rich people's showers were better. The jets buffeted and massaged from every angle, numbing in their ferocity, so that after a while it was hard to tell where the water started and my body ended. I soaped my hair, then shaved my legs, and finally I just stood underneath the stream watching the sea and the sky and the circling gulls. I'd left the bathroom door open so I could see across the bed, out to the veranda and the sea beyond. And the effect was just... well, I'm not going to lie, it was pretty nice. I guess you had to get something for the 8 grand or whatever it was they were charging for this place. The amount was slightly obscene in comparison to my salary, or even Rowan's salary. I had spent years drooling over the reports she sent back from a villa in the Bahamas or a yacht in the Maldives, waiting for the day when I, too, would be senior enough to get those kinds of perks. But now I was actually getting a taste of it. I wondered, how did she stand it? These regular glimpses into a life no regular person would ever be able to afford. I was idly trying to work out how many months I'd have to work to pay for a week on the Aurora as a passenger when I heard something. An indistinct little noise beneath the roar of the water that I couldn't place, but definitely sounded like it came from my room. My heart quickened a little, but I kept my breathing firm and steady as I opened my eyes to turn the shower off. Instead, I saw the bathroom door swinging towards me, as though someone had shoved it with a swift, sure hand. It banged shut, the solid, firm clunk of a heavy door that was made of the very best quality material, and I was left in the hot, wet dark, with the water pounding on the top of my skull and my heart beating hard enough to register on the boat's sonar. I couldn't hear anything above the hiss of blood in my ears and the roar of the shower. And I couldn't see anything apart from the red gleam of the digital controls to the shower. Fuck. Fuck. Why hadn't I double-locked the cabin door? I felt the walls of the bathroom closing in on me, the blackness seeming to swallow me whole. Stop panicking, I told myself. No one's hurt you. No one's broken in. Chances are it's just a maid come to turn down the bed. Or the door shutting by itself. Stop panicking. I forced myself to feel for the controls. The water went freezing, then agonizingly hot, so that I yelped and staggered back, cracking my ankle against the wall. But then finally I found the right button. The stream stopped and I groped my way to the light. They came on, flooding the little room with an unforgiving glare, and I stared at myself in the mirror. Bone white, with wet hair plastered to my skull like the girl from The Ring. Shit. Was this what it was going to be like? Was I turning into someone who had panic attacks about walking home from the tube or staying the night alone in the house without their boyfriend? No, fuck that. I would not be that person. There was a bathrobe on the back of the door, and I swathed it hastily around myself and then took a deep, shaking breath. I would not be that person. I opened the bathroom door, my heart beating so hard and fast that I was seeing stars in my vision. Do not panic, I thought fiercely. The room was empty. Completely empty. And the door was double-locked. Even the chain was across. There was no way anyone had got in. Maybe I'd just heard someone in the corridor. Either way, it was obviously just the movement of the ship that had caused the door to swing shut, impelled by its own weight. I checked the chain again, feeling the thick weight of it heavy in the palm of my hand, reassuringly solid, and then, on weak legs, I made my way to the bed and lay down, my heart still pounding with suppressed adrenaline, and waited for my pulse to return to something approaching normal. I imagined burying my face in Judah's shoulder, and for a second I nearly burst into tears. But I clenched my teeth and swallowed it back down. Judah was not the answer to all this. The problem was me and my weak-ass panic attacks. Nothing happened. Nothing happened. I repeated it in time with my rapid breaths until I felt myself begin to calm. Nothing happened. Not now. Not then. Nobody hurt you. Okay. God, I needed a drink. Inside the minibar was tonic, ice, and half a dozen miniatures of gin, whiskey, and vodka.
I shook ice into a tumbler and then emptied a couple of miniature bottles on top, pouring with a hand that still shook slightly. I topped up with a splash of tonic water and gulped it down. The gin was so strong it made me choke, but I felt the warmth of the alcohol spreading through my cells and blood vessels and felt instantly better. When the glass was empty, I stood up, feeling the lightness in my head and limbs, and pulled my phone out of my bag. No reception, so clearly we were out of range, but there was Wi-Fi. I clicked on Mail and watched, chewing my nails, as the emails popped one by one into the inbox. It wasn't quite as bad as I'd been fearing. It was a Sunday, after all. But as I scanned down the list, I realized I was tense as an elastic band about to snap. And at the same time, I understood what I was looking for and why. There was nothing from Judah. I felt my shoulders slump. I answered the few that were urgent, marked the others unread, and then pressed compose. Dear Judah, I wrote, but the rest of the words wouldn't come. I wondered what he was doing right now. Was he packing his bag, crammed onto some economy flight, or was he lying in some anonymous hotel room, tweeting, texting, thinking of me? I relived again the moment I'd smashed the heavy metal lamp into his face. What had I been thinking? You weren't thinking, I told myself. You were half asleep. It's not your fault. It was an accident. Freud says there are no accidents, said the voice in the back of my head. Maybe it's you. I shook my head, refusing to listen. Dear Judah, I love you. I miss you. I'm sorry. I deleted the email and started a new one. To Pamela Crewe, from Laura Blacklock. Sent Sunday 20th of September. Subject, safe and sound. Hi, Mum. Safe on board the boat, which is seriously swanky. You love it. Just a quick reminder to pick up Delilah tonight. I've left her basket on the table and the food is under the sink. I had to change the locks. Mrs. Johnson upstairs has the new key. Lots of love and thanks. Lo. Kiss, kiss. I pressed send, then pulled up Facebook and messaged my best friend, Lissy. This place is insanely nice. There is unlimited free drink in the minibar in my cabin. Sorry, I meant fucking enormous sweet, which doesn't bode well for my professionalism or my liver. See you on the other side, if I'm still standing. Lo. Kiss, kiss. I poured myself another gin and went back to Judah's email. I had to write something. I couldn't leave things the way they were when I walked out. I thought for a moment, then typed, Dear Jay, I'm sorry I was such a bitch before I left. What I said, it was incredibly unfair. I love you so much. I had to stop because tears were blurring the screen. I paused and took a couple of shaking breaths. Then I scrubbed crossly at my eyes and finished. Text me when you're there. Safe journey. Lo. Kiss, kiss, kiss. I refreshed my inbox, less hopefully this time, but nothing new downloaded. I sighed and drained my second gin. The clock by the bed said 6:30, which meant it was time for ball gown number one. Rowan, after she'd informed me that the dress code for dining on board was formal, translation, insane, had recommended that I hire at least 7 evening dresses so that I wouldn't have to wear the same dress twice. But since she wasn't proposing to stump up the cost, I had hired 3, which was 3 more than I'd have done if left to my own devices.
My favourite in the shop had been the most over-the-top, a long, silvery white sheath studded with crystals, which, the shop assistant had claimed without a glimmer of sarcasm, made me look like Liv Tyler in Lord of the Rings. I'm not sure I kept my face sufficiently straight, because she kept shooting me suspicious looks as I tried on the others. But I wasn't feeling quite brave enough to kick off with crystal studs, given there might well be people there wearing jeans for all I knew, so I picked out the most modest choice, a long, narrow slip in dark grey satin. There was a little spritz of sequined leaves across the right shoulder, but you didn't seem to be able to get away with none. Apparently, the majority of ball dresses were designed by 5-year-old girls armed with glitter guns, but at least this one didn't look entirely like an explosion in a Barbie factory. I wriggled into it and zipped it up the side. Then I shook out the full array of ammo from my makeup bag. It was going to take more than a swipe of lip gloss to get me looking even halfway human tonight. I was just smudging concealer across the cut on my cheekbone when I realised my mascara wasn't among the clutter. I hunted through my handbag in the vain hope that it might be there, trying to remember where I'd last seen it. Then I realised. It had been in my handbag, pinched along with everything else. I don't always wear it, but without dark lashes, my smoky eye makeup looked strange and out of proportion, like I'd given up halfway through. I thought, briefly and ridiculously, about improvising with liquid eyeliner, but instead I tried one last vain hunt in my bag, tipping everything out onto the bed just in case I'd misremembered or had a spare one stuck in the lining. In my heart, though, I knew it wasn't there, and I was putting everything back into the bag when I heard a noise from the cabin next door. The roar of the pressurized toilet flushing, recognizable even above the muted hum of the engine. Taking my keycard in my hand, I went out barefoot into the corridor. The ashwood door to my right had a little plaque saying, 10, Palmgren, which made me think that the supply of eminent Scandinavian scientists must have worn a little thin by the time they'd finished fitting out this boat. I knocked hesitantly. There was no answer. I waited. Maybe the occupant was in the shower. I knocked again. 3 sharp knocks. And then, as an afterthought, a final loud whack in case they were hard of hearing. The door flew open, as if the occupant had been standing on the other side. "What?" she demanded, almost before the door had opened. "Is everything okay?" And then her face changed. "Shit. Who are you?" "I'm your neighbour," I said. She was young and pretty, with long dark hair, and was wearing a ratty Pink Floyd t-shirt with holes, which somehow made me like her quite a lot. "Laura Blacklock, Low. Sorry, I know this sounds really weird, but I wondered if I could borrow some mascara." There was a scatter of tubes and creams visible on the dressing table behind her, and she was wearing quite a bit of eye makeup herself, which made me fairly sure I was on safe ground. "Oh!" She looked flustered. "Right. Hang on." She disappeared, closing the door behind her, and then came back with a tube of Maybelline and stuck it into my hand. "Hey, thanks," I said. "I'll bring it right back." "Keep it," she said. I protested automatically, but she waved my words away. "Seriously, I don't want it back." "I'll wash the brush," I offered, but she shook her head impatiently. "I told you, I don't want it back." "Okay," I said, taken aback. "Thanks." "You're welcome." She shut the door in my face. I went back to my cabin, wondering about the odd little encounter. I felt out of place enough on this trip, but she looked even more of a fish out of water. Someone's daughter, maybe? I wondered if I'd see her at dinner. I'd just finished applying the borrowed mascara when there was a knock at the door. Maybe she'd changed her mind. "Hey," I said, opening the door, holding it out. But it was a different girl outside, one wearing a steward's uniform. Her eyebrows had been rather savagely overplucked, giving her an expression of permanent surprise.
"Hello," she said, with a sing-song Scandinavian inflection. "My name is Carla, and I'm your suite attendant along with Josef. This is just a courtesy call to remind you of the presentation at..."
"I remember," I said, rather more brusquely than I'd intended. 7 p.m. in the Pippi Longstocking room, or whatever it's called.
"Ah, I see you know your Scandinavian writers," she beamed.
"I'm not so hot on the scientists," I admitted. "I'll be right up."
"Wonderful. Lord Bulmer is looking forward to welcoming you all on board."
After she'd gone, I rummaged in my case for the wrap that had come with the dress, a sort of grey silk shawl that made me feel like a long-lost Bronte sister, and draped it round my shoulders. I locked the door behind me, slotted the key card inside my bra, and then made my way along the corridor and up to the Lindgren Lounge. Chapter 7. White. White. Everything was white. The pale wood floor, the velvet sofas, the long raw silk curtains, the flawless walls. It was spectacularly impractical for a public vessel. Deliberately so, I had to assume. Another Swarovski chandelier hung from the ceiling, and I couldn't help but pause in the doorway, more than a little dazed. It wasn't just the light, the way it glinted and refracted from the crystals on the ceiling. It was something about the scale. The room was like a perfect replica of a drawing room in a 5-star hotel, or a reception room on the QE2, but it was small. There could not have been more than 12 or 15 people in the room, and yet they filled the space, and even the chandelier was scaled down to fit. It was like looking in through the doorway of a doll's house, where everything is miniaturized and yet slightly off-kilter, the replica cushions just a little too large and stiff for the tiny chairs, the wine glasses the same size as the fake champagne bottle. I was just scanning the room, looking for the girl in the Pink Floyd t-shirt, when a low, amused voice came from the corridor behind me.
"Blinding, isn't it?"
I turned to see the mysterious Mr. Lederer standing there. "Just a touch," I said. He held out his hand.
"Cole Lederer."
The name was faintly familiar, but I couldn't put my finger on it.
"Laura Blacklock."
We shook, and I took him in. Even in jeans and a t-shirt, struggling up the gangway, he was what Lissy would have called eye candy. Now, he was wearing a dinner jacket in a way that made me remember Lissy's rule of thumb. A DJ added 33% to a man's attractiveness.
"So,"
he said, taking a glass off a tray proffered by yet another smiling Scandinavian stewardess.
"What brings you to the Aurora, Miss Blacklock?"
"Oh, call me Lo. I'm a journalist. I work for Velocity."
"Well, very happy to meet you, Lo. Can I offer you a drink?"
He picked up a second flute and held it out with a smile. The empty miniatures in the cabin floated up before my eyes, and I wavered for a moment, knowing I was on the cusp of drinking too much so early in the evening, but not wanting to seem rude. My stomach was very, very empty, and the gin hadn't quite worn off. But surely one more glass couldn't hurt.
"Thanks," I said at last.
He handed it over, his fingers brushing mine in a way I wasn't sure was accidental, and I took a gulp, trying to drown my nerves.
"How about you? What's your role here?"
"I'm a photographer," he said,
and I suddenly realized where I'd heard the name before.
"Cole Lederer!"
I exclaimed. I was ready to kick myself. Rowan would have been all over him right from the gangway.
"Of course!
He did that amazing shoot for The Guardian of the melting ice caps.
That's right.
He grinned, unashamedly pleased at being recognized, though you would have thought the thrill would have worn off for him by now. The guy was only a couple of steps down from David Bailey.
I've been invited to cover this trip. You know, moody shots of the fjords and stuff.
It's not usually your thing, is it? I said doubtfully.
No,
he agreed.
I tend to do endangered species or at-risk environments these days. And I don't think you could say this lot were at any particular risk of extinction. They all look extremely well-fed.
We gazed around the room together. I had to agree with him when it came to the men. There was a little knot in the far corner who looked like they could survive for several weeks off their fat reserves, if we were ever shipwrecked. The women were a different story, though. They all had that lean, polished look that spoke of hot Bikram yoga and a macrobiotic diet, and they didn't look like they'd survive long if the ship went down. Maybe they could eat one of the men. I recognized a few faces from other press shindigs. There was Tina West, whippet thin and with jewellery weighing more than she did, who edited the Vernean Times. Motto, 80 days is just the start. The travel journalist Alexander Belhom, who wrote features and foodie articles for a number of cross-channel and in-flight magazines, and was as sleek and rotund as a walrus. And Archer Fenlon, a well-known expert on extreme travel. Archer, who was maybe 40 but looked older with his permatanned, weathered face, was shifting from foot to foot, looking distinctly uncomfortable in his tie and dinner jacket. I couldn't quite imagine what he was doing here. His normal beat was eating witchetty grubs up the Amazon, but maybe he was having a bit of time off. I couldn't see the girl from the next door cabin anywhere.
Boo!
Said a voice behind me. I whipped round. Ben Howard. What the hell was he doing here? He was grinning at me through a thick hipster beard that was new since I'd last seen him. Ben, I said thinly, trying to suppress my shock. How are you? Have you met Cole Lederer? Ben and I used to be at Velocity together. Now he writes for the... What is it at the moment? Indie? Times?
Me and Cole know each other, Ben said easily. We cover that Greenpeace thing together. How's it going, man?
All right, Cole said. They did that sort of manly half-hug thing where you're too metrosexual for a handshake and not hip enough for a fist bump.
Looking good, Blacklock, Ben said, turning to me and giving me the once-over in a way that made me want to knee him in the balls,
except that the sodding dress was too tight.
Although, have you, been cage-fighting again?
For a minute, I couldn't work out what he was on about. Then I realized. The bruise on my cheek. Obviously, my expertise with the concealer wasn't as good as I'd thought. The flashing memory of the door slamming into my cheek and the man in my flat. About Ben's height, with the same liquid dark eyes. Was so vivid that my heart quickened and my chest felt tight. And for a long moment, I couldn't find the words to reply. I just stared at him, not trying to keep the ice out of my expression.
Sorry, sorry, he held up a hand. My own beeswax, I know. Christ, this collar's tight.
He yanked at his bow tie.
How did you land this gig, then? Going up in the world?
Rowan's ill, I said shortly.
Cole!
A voice broke into the awkward pause, and we all turned to look. It was Tina, sashaying smoothly across the pristine white oak floor, her silver dress rustling like a snakeskin. She gave Lederer a lingering kiss on both cheeks, ignoring me and Ben.
Sweetie, it's been far too long.
Her voice was throaty with emotion.
And when are you going to do that shoot you promised for the Vernean?
Hi, Tina,
Cole said, with just a touch of weariness in his tone.
"Let me introduce you to Richard and Lars," she purred, and slipping her arm through his, she bore him off to the knot of men I'd noticed at the beginning. He allowed himself to be carried away with just a little rueful smile over his shoulder as he went. Ben watched him go and then turned back to me, cocking an eyebrow with such perfect comic timing that I let out a snort.
"I think we both know who the belle of the ball is, right?"
he said dryly, and I had to nod.
"So how are you, anyway?"
he continued.
"Still with the Yank?"
What could I say?
"I don't know.
There's a strong possibility I might have screwed things up enough to have lost him."
"Still very much unavailable," I said at last, sourly.
"Shame. But, you know, what happens in the fjords stays in the fjords."
"Oh, piss off, Howard," I snapped. He put his hands up.
"Can't blame a guy for trying."
"Yes, I can," I thought, but I didn't say it. Instead, I grabbed another glass from a passing waitress and looked round for something to change the subject.
"Who are the others, then?" I asked.
"I've got you, me, Cole, Tina and Archer ticked off. Oh, and Alexander Belhom. What about that crowd over there?" I nodded at the little group Tina was chatting to. There were three men and two women, one of them about my age, but about £50,000 better dressed, and the other, well, the other was sort of a surprise.
"That's Lord Bulmer and his cronies. You know, he's the owner of the boat and the... I guess you'd call it the company figurehead."
I stared at the group, trying to spot Lord Bulmer from the snap on Wikipedia. At first, I couldn't work out which one he was. And then one of the men gave a full-throated laugh, throwing back his head, and I knew at once it was him. He was tall, wirily slim, and dressed in a suit so well cut that I was certain it must be tailored. And he was fiercely tanned, as if he spent a lot of time outdoors. His bright blue eyes narrowed into slits as he laughed, and there was a streak of grey at each temple, but it was the greyness that comes with extremely black hair, not old age. "He's so young. Seems kind of weird for someone our age to be a peer. Don't you think?"
"He's Viscount something as well, I think. The money's mainly down to his wife, of course. She's the Lyngstad heiress. Her family were car manufacturers. You know the ones I mean."
I nodded. My business knowledge might be shaky, and the family might be famously private, but even I'd heard of the Lyngstad Foundation. Every time you saw footage of an international disaster zone, their logo was on the trucks and aid parcels. I had a sudden memory of a shot I'd seen all over the papers last year. It might even have been one of Cole's, of a Syrian mother standing in front of a Lyngstad-branded truck with a baby in her arms, holding the child up towards the driver like a talisman to make the vehicle stop.
"And is that her?"
I nodded at the willowy white blonde with her back to me, who was laughing at something one of the other men had said. She was dressed in a devastatingly simple gown of rose-coloured wild silk that made me feel like I'd cobbled mine together from my childhood dressing-up box. Ben shook his head.
"Oh, she's Chloe Jensen. Ex-model and married to that chap with the blonde hair, Lars Jensen. He's a big noise in finance, head of a large Swedish investment group.
I imagine Bulmer's got him here as a potential investor. No, that's Bulmer's wife next to him, in the headscarf."
"Oh."
She was the surprise. In contrast to the others in the group, the woman in the headscarf looked... well, she looked ill. She was wearing a kind of shapeless grey silk kimono wrap that matched her eyes, halfway between an evening dress and a dressing gown, but even from here I could see she was wearing a silk scarf wound around her scalp, and her skin was waxily pale. Her pallor stood out sharply against the rest of the group, who looked almost obscenely healthy in comparison. I realized I was staring and dropped my eyes.
"She's been ill," Ben said unnecessarily. "Breast cancer. I think it was pretty serious."
"How old is she?"
"Barely 30, I think."